Lord, we want to turn our eyes towards you this morning again. I want this morning, this day, just to be a day that's just saturated in the presence of Christ, God, that just has your fingerprints all over it, that people feel you in a very tangible way, that they know that you're here, that they experience you. So often in life, we just kind of float through with just kind of this vague notion of you as an absentee landlord, that you're just kind of out there and we're left here to figure it all out. But I want people to know this morning that you're with them in a very real and profound way. Thank you, Lord. In the name of Christ, amen. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning.
I thought you were going to be wearing your costume today. I'm a little disappointed.
This is it.
Pump up the volume. What are you, a DJ? Where are you going? We've been in this series, and we're calling it Eat It. I should have put that at the very beginning. My wife makes fun of me for the name of the series. We have our, we're eating our ways basically through the book of Luke. We're talking about the way that Jesus, all the meals that he engaged in the book of Luke. And so we have this little table set up to remind us that in the book of Luke, it said that Jesus is either at a meal, he's going to a meal, or he's leaving a meal. And you can trace this kind of structure all throughout the book of Luke. And we've talked about, where did we start? We started with Jesus going to Levi, the tax collector's house. And we started there. And then we talked about Simon the Pharisee, the woman who anoints Jesus' feet at Simon the Pharisee's house. We talked about Jesus feeding the 5,000. We talked about Jesus at Mary and Martha's house. We talked about last week we talked about Jesus as he heals the man with dropsy. And at this narrative, Jesus is at a Pharisee, like a ruler or a Pharisee supervisor's house, right? They're really trying to kind of tighten the screws to Jesus. So this time Jesus gets invited to the supervisor's house. And that's where we're going to pick it up in Luke 14. And I'm going to just continue this series in a little bit of a way. And so this is kind of the seed of death, part two. And we're going to talk about vulnerability today. But let's read this text together. Last week we started off just to kind of give this image is that Jesus is at this dinner. The way that it would be set up in the ancient Near East, they do this very similar. I didn't have the other pictures, but it's called a triclinium where you just kind of have these three tables. Typically, the guests of honor here is represented by the Queen of England, kind of sit up towards the top. And then as any meal, right, you just kind of importance, you just kind of get fanned out down the bottom, right? So this might be, I don't know, maybe the prince and the princess sit up here, and then maybe the heads of state down here might just be some cabinet members or kind of whatever. But it just kind of starts that the people that are head of honor sit up here, and then it just kind of fans out. We made the assumption last week that where Jesus and dropsy guy are sitting are somewhere down here, right? We're talking about Jesus, and we're saying that this is what we're calling the seat of death. So let's read it, and we'll do a little recap, and then we're going to kind of extend onto this. Somebody got that and want to read it for me? Luke 14, 1 through 14. And I was like, Elliot, you're waiting.
Huh? I'm like, what if
nobody volunteered? I mean, I can read it. I'm good, but you want to go for it, Elliot?
Yeah, I'm there.
Okay.
One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?" And they had nothing to say. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous.
Okay. This is the narrative of Jesus at the prominent Pharisee's house where he heals the man with dropsy. we made the assumption last week too, or not the assumption, we made the discovery that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. And as he's on his way to Jerusalem, he's going to Jerusalem to do what?
To die.
To die, right? Jesus went through the towns and the villages, teaching as he made his way to Jerusalem in Luke 13, just a few verses later. In any case, I must press on today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside of Jerusalem. Jesus is heading to Jerusalem. He knows clearly what his mission, what his vocation is. He's got death on his mind. It's sharpening his focus. It's clarifying his purpose. He knows exactly what's happening. Robert Capone, in his commentary, says that when Jesus says choose the lowest or the last seat, he uses this Greek word eschaton, right? The lowest or the last, which is in Greek eschaton. And he says eschaton, or the lowest or last, suggests the precise seat we are invited into, the seat specifically reserved for each one of us is death. For not only is death our last and lowest state, but it is also the state that is the sole condition of our resurrection. So Jesus is saying, you choose the last seat, you choose the lowest seat. This is the seat of death. When you choose that seat of death, right? Jesus is always talking on multiple levels. And when you choose that seat of death, that lowest or that last seat, in there is where you find resurrection. It's where you find healing, right? Dropsy guy doesn't get healed because he's really likable, or he has great personality, or he's done something to merit his healing. He just gets healed just because he happens to be sitting in the seat of death next to Jesus. Okay? So we're going to talk about death this morning. And death is not a very exciting sermon. It's not a very inspiring sermon. I doubt many of you are going to go, wow, we was such a sermon of death. Wow, this is so good. But last week we kind of finished this and we said we have to choose the seat of death. And a lot of us, we kind of got to the discussion part. We were kind of like, I got it. Wait a second. How do I do that, right? How do we actually engage this seat of death? Now, as we talk about death, let's talk about two aspects first here. I would say that there's two things that we're going to talk about with death. One, there's, I call it the singly, the singular, the transitional, the baptismal. There is the death that we experience when we follow Christ, when we turn our lives over to Christ. Galatians, Paul says, you have been crucified with Christ and you no longer live, right? But Christ lives within you. So there is a death where you are literally crucified, right? And now you are living with Christ. In Colossians 3:3, Paul again says, you have died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. Right? In John 5:24, Jesus says that when you believe in him, when you trust in him, you go from death to life. So in some senses, this is just choosing the seat at the end of the wedding table. Kathleen, this is what you were talking about last week when you said there is like this kind of singular death. And when you choose this death, when you follow Jesus, you enter into that death, right? And then you're raised out of it. We said last week when in the early church, Christians weren't told to pray a prayer of salvation. They were baptized into death, right? Baptism is a symbol that when they put you under the water, you die to your old way. And when you come up out of the water, you are brought back to life and you're literally dripping with the presence of Christ. Okay? So there is this death, this singular or singly or transitional or baptismal death. And this is what Jesus says. He says, go choose the seat, the death seat at the end of the table. That's to choose that seat, to choose to be there with Jesus. And then the second part of this is that there's an ongoing death, right? When Jesus says in Luke 9:23, just a few chapters before this, he says, I want you to take up your cross. Anybody know the next word?
Daily.
Daily, right? To take up the cross daily would be an image that each day you're going to wake up, you're going to pick up your cross, and you're going to go die. Right? You're going to die to yourself. You're going to die to all the ways that you have to be first, the ways that, all the, that you have to be big, that you have to be important, that you have to have your way. Right? In John 3:30, John the Baptist, one of the last prophets, he says, I must decrease so that Jesus can increase. When you decrease, that is a certain internal death, right? That's saying that I'm not going to get my way all the time. I'm not going to try and be the most important person. I'm going to decrease, right? So I would say that the singular death is to choose a seat at the end of the wedding table, and the ongoing death is to stay at the end of the wedding table, right? Of the banquet table that Jesus is talking about. If this is to give names to this, I would say what we saw with Billy Graham's ministry, when Billy Graham would call people to this transitional death and he would give these great revival services and he would say, give your life over to Jesus, die to yourself. This is Billy Graham right here, right? And we saw Billy Graham's ministry. And I would say this is what we're seeing a lot of probably currently with some great thinkers like Dallas Willard and Richard Foster and Jan Johnson, where they're saying, look, it's not enough just to give your life to Jesus, right? Like, okay, so you give your life to Jesus, that there is this ongoing death. This is called discipleship, right? This is where the disciplines come in to where you say, okay, what are the things that I need to do in my life to continue to crucify my flesh, to continue to die to my own flesh, right? Do I need to partake in fasting? Do I need to partake in prayer? Do I need to partake in study? Do I need to partake in a church community? What are the continual things that I need to partake in that I may continually ongoing die to death? Everybody with me on that so far? This is the two deaths we talked about last week. and if none of that makes sense, you can just go home and watch this movie, and that should make it all click. I got a lot of laugh. I thought that wasn't even get one laugh, but thank you guys for all laughing. Maybe it's just Pierce Brosnan and it's just, is this, like he's serious about dying another day.
It's kind of like he wants you to see him shooting someone. You know what I mean? He wants to look good while he's like doing his job.
He's actually a Christian.
He is?
He makes a profession of faith. Yes. Now, I don't know when, but yes, I've seen a little blurb on Christian celebrities.
So he did die another day.
Give me a sec, because I want to make a joke. Because I could just see Kirk Cameron playing this and making it a Christian movie. The three names would be, I would say Dallas Willard. I would say Dallas Willard.
It looks way older than 2002. That looks like 1975 or 85.
He was like the worst of the James Bond guys, wasn't he? Yeah. Yeah.
George Lazenby was a great.
Dallas Willard.
And
Richard Foster. Richard Foster wrote the classic book, The Celebration of Discipline. Dallas Willard wrote The Divine Conspiracy. And Jan Johnson is just a dear friend, and anytime I can plug her and her work, I do it. And if you haven't read her, she has Abundant Simplicity. She just came out with a new book. She has another one called Invitation to the Jesus Life. She's just a remarkable author. We've had her here, and we need to do that again at some point soon. Okay, good. In discussion last week, as we were sharing, let's get on to what I really want to talk about today. In discussion last week, as we were sharing, Elliot, you were speaking, and I kind of felt guilty at the moment. But we're talking about death and how to choose death. And Elliot, you're speaking, and I got up while you were speaking, and I went back in there and I grabbed a Sharpie, right? And maybe you guys were like thinking like, wow, that's kind of rude. He just walked away from Elliot while he was speaking. I had two thoughts because we were talking about, again, how do we choose death? How do we live into death? And so I took my table diagram that we had last week and I wrote a couple notes here and I said death. And then I have three things here that I want to talk about. Vulnerability, finance, and then I want to talk about relationships. Vulnerability, finance, and I want to talk about relationships. And I realize I've never done this before. I was preparing this week's sermon on vulnerability, and this is just a whole sermon in itself. And I'm going to talk next week about, well, not next week, in 2 weeks I'm going to talk about finance, and I realize that's a whole other sermon in itself. And then the last week I want to talk about dying in relationships, and realize that that's a whole other sermon in itself. And then Elliot and I were talking, and we might even have another sermon. We're going to press, I've never done this, usually when I have a series, boom, I just do it. We're going to press pause on this series. We're going to talk about the death of vulnerability. We're going to talk about death and finances, and we're going to talk about death and relationships over the next couple weeks. And then Elliot and I are still scheming maybe one more out of this. So this whole Eat It series is going to kind of be on pause for a second. We're going to stay in this narrative. We're going to stay in Luke 14, and we're just going to keep going through this. You guys with me on that? We're going to really learn how to... There was a pastor that I saw. He did a series called Death to Selfie. Cute. So we're going to... I don't know if I can pull that one off, but we're going to do Death to Selfie. All right, let's go this way. Let's look at this image. What do we have? What do we got going on here? Picking teams, thank you. Mark, what? Dodgeball? You're not even close. There's a soccer ball right here. are you looking here, right here, in this?
Yeah.
Okay. Who knows? And I don't see any goal. I don't know. Okay. What I wanted to get out here is they're picking teams, right? You got the two captains. You got Under Armour Kid right here, and you got O'Doyle over here. This guy's got the dog. I think he's got a dog tag on, so you know he's tough. And they're picking teams. Anybody got a painful memory from when they were a kid about this moment in life? Kai? Anybody got a pain? Maybe it was like at work, at an office, you were being picked for a team or for a project or for a committee, right? When I was in Kansas, not this past time just here in September, when I was in Kansas back in... I can see there's a little bit of discussion. People want to talk about that. When I was in Kansas back in March, it's this cohort. There's about 30 or so pastors. And we're playing a game one night. And the woman who is organizing the game says, all right, we need two team captains. We're going to pick teams. And immediately, because you start picking teams and it's all good. But then you get down to about the last six or seven people. Anybody just cringe thinking about that? And you're just like, oh, man, somebody, seriously, we're grown people, grown adults, and someone's going to get picked last. And it still hurts, right? Imagine we did that here this morning. We picked teams, and you were the last one picked. It's not much of a confidence booster, right? And so we did this at the Apprentice Experience. And again, I just kind of watched it. Just so you guys know, sleep safe, your pastor was not picked last, okay? So you guys can just know that I was not picked last. I wasn't picked first, but somewhere in the mix. But it's just kind of like this cringy being picked last. Let me share another story with you about that vulnerability or that embarrassment or that humiliation of being picked last. And this is a little bit more table-oriented. This is one of the biggest regrets of I would say, not only my high school experience. This might be one of my biggest regrets of my life. I still have a very painful memory about this. So we had a table that we all sat at. It was a round table, right? We all sat around the round table, me and my buddies. You guys know what I'm talking about? You guys back in high school right now? At lunch. Sorry about that, at lunch. We had a round table that we sat at lunch. Maybe you guys sat at the long picnic tables or you sat at outside on the grass, I don't know. We'll save that for next week's sermon, Mark. So we all sit around this round table at lunch. There was an Asian kid that went to our school. Now, I was born in rural Pennsylvania. There's a lot of racism kind of growing up in rural Pennsylvania. And this Asian kid, his name was Shiloh. And Shiloh, he was an incredible cross-country runner. He was a small, kind of small Asian kid, really, really fast cross-country runner. I remember that about Shiloh. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it was overt racism or what it was, but he kind of was on the fringe of this table, right? I remember this one particular lunch. We're all sitting around having lunch at this table. And let me just be real honest just to paint a picture. And again, this just, I get sick to my stomach just thinking about this. We would make fun of the kid pretty bad. We would call him Gook. We would call him a lot of different racial names. And sometimes in high school as boys, that's just kind of part of the deal, is you just kind of pick on each other and kind of have that kind of relationship with the tough skin. But this particular lunch, and I'll never forget this, one of my friends, his name was Josh, he said, "Shiloh, you're not allowed to sit at our table today." And so we're all sitting around the table, and Shiloh just sits off of the table, and he has a chair, and he's eating the lunch on his lap, like 2 feet away from the table. I'll never forget this. And again, I watch this, and I'm the my biggest regret is obviously that I didn't have the courage to say anything, right? To go sit with the kid. I mean, there's to just say this isn't right, you know, to make a stand for the kid. And again, by not saying anything, I've said it all, didn't I? Yeah. And so Shiloh just sits there off the end of the table, and I'll just never forget. And I know exactly, I could walk into my cafeteria, I could say we sat at that table, I could tell you where I sat, I could tell you exactly where he sat. I'll never forget that. And when I think about Jesus, and when I think about this, this embarrassment, this humiliation, this vulnerability, when I think about Jesus choosing the end seat at the table, I almost picture Jesus as Shiloh, and he's just kind of sitting off the edge of the table, and the Pharisees say, "That'll teach him." Again, we talked about how the Pharisees wanted to honor and or humiliate and dishonor and shame Jesus. They never were trying to value him or esteem him. And I see Jesus almost sitting at the end. I see Jesus kind of here getting picked last, right? And so this sitting at the end of the table, again, the word that I want to focus in on this morning is I want to focus in on this word vulnerable. How does Shiloh feel as he's sitting off of that table? It's a position of incredible vulnerability, right? How do you feel if we in this room decided we're going to pick teams to play dodgeball and you're picked last, right? Even as adults, that would still, anybody that would like, yeah, that would sting a little bit, right? There's a vulnerability in there. Brené Brown, who's done more research on this than anyone else. Anybody familiar with Brené Brown? No one. Okay. The Glisten girls know who Brené Brown is. I'll give some resources for Brené Brown because I think she's spoken about this in just so many remarkable ways. Brené Brown is quoted in another book that I was reading for my class. And let me just read this, kind of a lengthy quote, but this kind of defines vulnerability. She says, or this guy's name's Tim Suttle, and he's referencing her work. After doing thousands of hours of interviews with thousands of people, Brown concluded that the world can be roughly divided into two groups. Those who experience a healthy sense of love and belonging, and those who don't. If you examine those two groups, what you will find is that in most ways they are identical. And he says age or gender, sexuality, hopes, dreams, successes, failures, addictions, tragedies, education, socioeconomics, you name it. The two groups are identical in every way except for one. So again, if you were just to look at the two groups, it doesn't matter who's in the group, right? What age they are, what gender they are, what sexuality they are. They're pretty much identical, right? And he says, quoting her, he says, those who experience a healthy sense of love and belonging, we could even say connection, believe they're worthy of those things. Those who do not experience a healthy sense of love and belonging do not believe they are worthy. He goes on to say this, worthiness, that's the difference. At this point, bells should be going off in our minds as we think about all the time and effort Jesus spent trying to get the lost, the left out, and the left behind to believe that deep down they were precious children of God. Anybody still got their Bible open to Luke 14? Somebody read to me just those last three verses.
12 through 14?
Mm-hmm.
Then Jesus said to his host, "When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous."
What is Jesus doing here, right here? Think about the people who are invited to this banquet. Think about the people who are trying to invite. He's trying to get the lost, the left out, and the left behind to believe that deep down they were precious children of God. Invite the lame, the crippled, the blind to a banquet. Right? Now, when we talk about vulnerability, and we're going to kind of circle back to it, but to understand vulnerability, we have to understand shame and how shame works in our lives. Brené Brown defines shame as this. She says, "It's an intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging." Now, this can sometimes be a small amount, right? This could be getting picked last if we were to play dodgeball here, and you kind of feel this like, man, maybe I'm just not really worthy to be picked, right? Or this could be a very deep wound. I think about my friend Shiloh sitting off that table, right? That one must have been an intensely painful feeling, right? Believing that he's unworthy of love and belonging, of connection into our table, right? So this is what shame is. Now, shame are the parts of us that that feel are most broken, and we keep shame hidden within us, right? These are the parts of our souls that need desperately to be known by God so he can be loved and healed. This is all the stuff that we keep in ourselves. This is what shame is. We are not very good at sharing intensely painful feelings or experiences, are we? This is the stuff we keep hidden inside of us. You might be asking, let me make a quick differentiation here between shame and guilt, okay? What is shame and what is guilt? Guilt is to say that I have done something bad, that I'm unworthy, that I've failed, right? Or that I've done something unworthy. What we talk about with shame is what happens with these intense, painful feelings or experiences is they leave us down here where they say, really, at the core of who I am bad. I am unworthy. I am a failure. Right? So the difference between guilt and shame is shame affects the very identity of who we are. Think about how often Jesus went around trying to convince people that they are worthy. Right? That they are worthy. Shame is connected with much of what we are trying to avoid in our lives. Right? This is what we try and avoid in our lives. And in the lives of our loved ones, we want to avoid failure. How many people are like, yeah, I'm cool, I'm a failure. Right? We avoid failure in our lives. We avoid our inadequacies. We avoid depression. We avoid childhood wounds. We avoid relational pain. We avoid imperfection. We avoid flaws and faults. This is all the things that we stuff down within us so that when we come to church on Sunday morning and somebody asks, how are you doing? You smile and you say, good. Right? We stuff all this down. Right? And shame's, maybe I can say this too. The first sermon we had this idea the second sermon we had this kind of concept where that woman, that sinful woman is pouring her perfume. She's probably a prostitute and she's pouring her perfume and wiping Jesus' feet with her hair, right? And with her tears. And we talked about that week. We said, imagine if we had an old film projector and we could get a roll of film from you of the worst 10 moments of your life. Imagine we could show a film of me sitting at that table laughing while my friend says, you can't sit at our table. And we all kind of laugh. And we show that on Sunday morning and you watch my face, right? Imagine we had a film of the bottom 10 moments of your life. How many people would be running out the door away from here? Only Mark, so everybody else must be pretty good. Johnny too, okay. Right? This is what, if you can think of any of those bottom 10 moments in your life, this is shame. Right? This is the film reel that you keep locked in a vault and nobody knows the key. Okay. Because we carry this shame, what shame triggers in us is shame triggers anger, aggression or passive aggression. It triggers violence. It triggers addiction. It triggers depression, eating disorders, lust, overcompensation, strength, silence and withdrawal. This is like kind of the symptoms of shame. If you find yourself getting very angry, if you find yourself being aggressive or very passive-aggressive, violent towards others, if you find yourself lost in addictions, depressions, eating disorders, lust, overcompensation, strength, this is all the symptoms of shame, right? And so when you have those 10, that bottom 10, and we just stuff and we stuff and we stuff and we never expose it, this is what you end up seeing in someone's life who's living by their shame, what's called a shame attendant, right? Let's bring it to modern day. We have, I don't know if you guys have seen the story or followed or tracked this story. This story was actually made more profound to me as I've been thinking and studying shame. We've seen the fall of this man, Mr. Harvey Weinstein, right? Mr. Harvey Weinstein, as of I think this week, 40 different women have come out and said that he sexually assaulted him or assaulted them, right? There's 40 different women. And I was thinking about this. If he's done this to 40 different women, why have none of these women spoken out ahead of time? Fear, shame, right? And you think about this because the majority of these women that he's assaulted, that he's molested, that he's done all these things to, they're famous, they're rich, they're established, they're loved, they're admired, and yet they all to a T pretty much remained silent, didn't they? It's shame. It's shame. Let me see if I want to go here first. No. Shame's primary function, this is the first thing that shame will do to you. It'll isolate you. It'll create a reality in which you are all alone or abandoned. Whatever that bottom 10 is, whatever that thing is in your soul, you think to yourself right now, nobody else in this room, nobody else in this world knows what I'm going through, and I will not tell anybody because of the shame. This is why I think all 40 of these women kept silent, is because how ashamed they were. They didn't want to talk about it until Miss Alyssa Milano came out and said that if you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write "Me Too" as a reply to this tweet, right? And this has been shared now over between 12 to 15 million times all over social media, people saying "Me Too." People coming out and saying, I don't want to be stuck in this trap of shame, right? It was so hidden, it was so suppressed that it was disintegrating their souls. Shame does its best work in the shadows, right? Shame does its best work in the shadows. Shame, J.R. Briggs says, it loves to take us by the arm and usher us into darkness and hiding. The ironic nature of shame is that no one wants to talk about it, and the less we talk about it, the more we feel, I inserted, the more we feed it. The more you stuff down the shame, the more it sits within you, the more you're feeding it. It's exactly what shame feeds on, is living in the shadows. Richard Rohr says, you'll never be able to heal what you cannot acknowledge. And like I said, it does its best work in the shadows. Going back to the celebrities, we know that shame doesn't discriminate. Doesn't matter how much money you have. Doesn't matter how famous you are. Doesn't matter how many admirers you have. Shame comes for us all. Rich, poor, different ethnicities, famous, normal. It comes for us all. When I was in Kansas, this actually, when we did the picking of the teams, we got to study under a guy named Kurt Thompson. And Kurt Thompson, he talked specifically about shame and vulnerability. We spent 2 days just talking about this, and this was back in March. And what he says that shame is he says that shame is a vector that evil wields to destroy and disintegrate and fragment the universe. Was that your grandson right there? Holy smokes, he's big and he's cute. Thank you. Wow.
He's excited to be here.
Let me say that one more time. Not to you, about your grandson. I could say that one more time. The way Thompson defines it is he says that shame is a vector, right? It's a tool that evil or Satan wields to destroy and disintegrate and fragment the universe. Again, shame, its primary function, it wants to break us down, it wants to isolate us, it wants us to make us feel abandoned, it wants to take the whole and tear us apart. That's what shame does, right? Genesis 3, if you go all the way back to the beginning of the story, the beginning of the narrative, that great verse, that they're naked and they felt no shame, right? And they disobey God. They break the shalom. And what's the first thing that they experience? Shame. Because they cover themselves, right? This is the primary function of evil, is to make us shamed and to isolate us and to disintegrate us and to make us cover up and to make us hide. That's why we don't talk about shame. That's why we continue to put more and more fig leaves on top of shame, right? So I would say we have this darkness, we have this hiding, this hole within us, we carry this shame, it's been leveraged against us, we feel isolated, we feel humiliated, we feel terrified, we refuse to even acknowledge it. And then there is a solution that I would say to overcome the shame. Am I talking to anybody this morning? They have this solution to overcome the shame, and this is where we're going to make a circle back to vulnerability. The way Brené Brown defines vulnerability, she says it's emotional exposure, it's uncertainty, and risk. I would say it's opening ourselves and exposing our shame. Right? Is that a hand?
Yeah, there's a saying in CR that says you're only as sick as your secrets. Because when you keep it in, you know, you stay emotionally and spiritually shamed.
Mm-hmm.
And like all these women coming out, you know, they get to just expose what happened and they don't have to live in the guilt or the shame of whatever happened to them. So, you know, it's like confess to somebody, your brother. But you're only as sick as your secrets.
You're only as sick as your secrets.
Expose those and get vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get into the light instead of the darkness.
That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. So vulnerability ends up being emotional exposure. It's, again, pulling ourselves into the light. It's uncertainty. It's risk. I think about how much in life, thinking about this first one, instead of exposing ourselves emotionally, how often do we just try and project strength? Think about social media and the way that social media is used to just project strength, right? Look how wonderful I am. Look how much I love people. Look how great my life experience is. We project all this strength and then we become a slave to those projections. How much of life do we try and minimize risk? How much in life do we try and know everything? Do we try and control? Do we try and minimize ambiguity? How much in life? We live in a seatbelt society that we try and minimize risk, right? That we try and avoid risk. So when we expose ourselves, when we open ourselves, there's a lot of uncertainty around this. There's a lot of risk around this, but it's an opening. And again, as you said, the only way to heal the shame is to bring it into the light, right? This is what being vulnerable is all about. We have this, Kurt Thompson calls it, when we were studying with him, we have a shame, he calls it the shame attendant, right? And if you wanted a picture of that, there's the classic devil on one shoulder, an angel on the other shoulder. Maybe you could just think about someone on your shoulder, a little shame attendant, right? And the shame attendant continues to whisper to us, you're alone, don't talk about it, people will look at you funny. People look at you weird. It's not that big of a deal. You can control it. How about this? Shame will often say, here's another distraction. Go numb yourself. People won't perceive you as perfect, right? And we understand that the only way to deal with shame is to bring it into the light. When we were in this kind of week-long period in Kansas back in March, so it's, again, about a cohort of about 30 folks. And then from those 30 folks, we break down into small groups that we've had for the past couple gatherings. And so we had this time in Kansas to open ourselves up and take a risk and to be vulnerable with some of our peers. And honest, like some of the, you know, obviously you're sitting in a small group. There's about four of us in our small group, five of us in our small group. And you have people sharing. And people are being open and people are being honest and people are being vulnerable. And then it comes my turn to share, right? And as it came my turn to share, I can guarantee that you're just, whatever your shame is, it makes your palms get sweaty, your heart rate increases, you're fidgeting in your chair, you're kind of nervously looking around the room, you're doing this, right? And then you open yourself up to people who love you and people who care about you. And you realize this shame attendant that you thought was this giant gorilla on your back was just a little mouse, was just a phantom, right? Kurt Thompson says that we love one another most when we are vulnerable with one another. We love one another most when we are vulnerable with one another. Vulnerability feels like weakness, but it looks like raw courage. You ever have somebody share openly and honest with you? And you see how courageous that moment is. Now, here's where I want to tie this all back into death. It took us a little bit, but we got there. Vulnerability, when you open yourself up, when you share that shame, when you expose yourself, when you take that uncertainty and that risk, it feels like an excruciating death. Again, if I were to ask you, take one moment out of your bottom 10 highlight reel of your life and share about it openly and honestly this morning. How many people are jumping out of their seat to do that? No one, right? No one. And if I said, you have to do this, it would be an excruciating death. But here is the thing, is that it feels like an excruciating death, but I would say that it's raw hope, right? It's absolutely raw hope. Vulnerability is, I think, one of the primary ways I think that we can choose death, right? It's a conscious decision to walk down to the end of the table or to sit off of the table like Shiloh did. I wish I could say my friend Shiloh. I don't even feel... I wish I was a better friend to him. It's a conscious decision to sit off of the table with Jesus, right? And sit there, and I would say this, at the end, only at the end of the table can Jesus take hold of us. This is what we're all so longing for, is that for Jesus to take hold of us and to tell us that we're worthy, that he loves us and that we belong. Think about all of the time and effort Jesus spends trying to get you to believe that deep down you are a precious child of God. You are worthy of his love and belonging no matter what your shame says. And she says, Wendy, you're only as sick as your deepest secrets. And we hide it. We hide it. It's a heavy one this morning. Sorry, we got a picnic and everything. We're supposed to be happy. Let me, I came up with just a few things. I'm going to close with this. Came up with a few things for us to help kind of break through with this. Let me share a couple things. This is, first off, this has been a theme that has been bumping around in my heart since I would say March. So for the last 6 or 7 months, I have been thinking about this. So I am not expecting this morning transformation and tears and everybody just to start weeping. And it's just, I expect that the way that the Lord works, right, is he plants a seed within us as he did with me in March. And then he watches it grow and he watches people expose themselves and he watches people grow and he watches people take risks amidst the uncertainty and bring whatever shame it is into light. This is what I've been experiencing over the last 6 or 7 months. Okay. And so I've been experiencing this. And again, as we talk about this, maybe for you this morning, this is just a seed. This is just kind of a start to say, okay, this thing that's going on in my soul that I've never told anyone about, I need to do something about this here, right? Here's a couple thoughts of ways to kind of to take steps in this direction. I would say, and this is stuff I've done, journal about it. You got to see it and you got to name it. You got to see what your shame is. You got to put it down on paper. You got to look at it in, so to speak, the face. And you got to say, I'm going to write this down. I'm going to name those bottom 10, those moments. I'm going to name what I would be terrified if anybody knew about me. And you just journal about it. And one of the things I've been doing over the past couple months is I just have this little journal that I just keep notes in, and I just keep writing about shame and the way that this affects my life, right? I don't know. This is kind of a weird step, but I thought maybe this would be helpful for people. Maybe you just video yourself just as kind of a confessional. You sit there with the phone and you just put your phone up there, and you're not going to like email it or send it out, but it's just a way to verbalize it, a different way to journal about it, but a way to verbalize it and just put it out there so it's at least, it's not just rotting within your soul anymore. Right? At least it's not just rotting within your soul. I can recommend two books. I can recommend Kurt Thompson's book. I got a chance to listen to him for about 2 days. He's a guy out of Washington. He's actually an MD. He's actually literally a doctor. And he's looked at the soul of, he's looked at shame, the way that it works within us. And he looks at the neurological ways that it works within us as well. And he's written an incredible book called The Soul of Shame. Brené Brown has a book called Daring Greatly. She has one of the most famous, not one of the most, she has an incredibly famous TED Talk on YouTube that I think is worth your 17 to 18 minutes. And that is just kind of an introduction into this kind of concept of shame and vulnerability and worthiness. My friend Keys from my program, he has this thing, and he says, you got to get soul naked. Damon, you like that one? You like the soul part. He says you got to get soul naked. You just got to get somebody who you can just kind of expose your soul to. This might be a spouse. Maybe it's a family member. Maybe it's a friend. Maybe it's a pastor. Dietra, don't let that girl disrespect you. You just got to get somebody who you can just say, I'm just going to share about this, right? And then the last thing, and again, because I don't know what you carry into this, right? This is something that I've been moving towards just because I see the need for it, to see a professional. I really believe in this. And again, I haven't made this leap. It's a leap that I'd like to make within the next couple months. Again, the Lord planted this seed in me back in March, and I'm still letting it grow, and I'm still processing it. This is a big part of me processing it. This is all the books that I've been reading. I keep addressing it for some reason. And so I'm still thinking about the way that this, my childhood wounds. I'm still thinking about the way my relationship with my, we just all have daddy issues as well, right? The way my relationship with my father affects me. And so maybe you see a professional. I see that word SIFT. SIFT is called the Center for Individual and Family Therapy. Here's their website, siftcounseling.com. They have a location right here off Catella, right across the street from the racetrack, more or less. You guys know that little industrial or that little office complex right there. They have an office right there. They have counseling if you need to see a counselor. They have spiritual direction, which is kind of like, it's like counseling, but maybe just offers a little bit more spirituality within that, a little bit more Christianity within that. They have so many great resources, and just for what it says, hope and healing and growth. So I would say that, again, maybe this warning is just a seed for you. This seed of, I got this within me. I'm terrified to expose it. But I know that Jesus tells me to choose death. And if I'm going to die, if I'm going to be resurrected, I'm going to have to deal with this. I'm going to have to bring this to light. And so this is what this could be a couple next steps for somebody in this room. For me, again, I've been doing number one. I've read Daring Greatly. I've read parts of The Soul of Shame. This is a hard one right here, I think, just to really expose yourself vulnerably. I'd like to begin to see a professional, maybe a spiritual director, someone who I can just, okay, this is what it is, right? Okay, that should be enough for the morning. Let me say a word of prayer, and then we'll jump into, you're just going to turn to the people next to you and share your deepest, darkest shame. We'll do some questions in a second. Did everybody get that? Did anybody else want to take a picture and write anything down? Everybody got that? I just pray, Lord, for the person who's sitting in here, and I pray that seeds were planted this morning again. I just know that this is the death that we have to choose. This vulnerability, and it's an experience of death, literally, is the only way to our resurrection. And the more we hide it, the more we bury it, the more it feeds itself, and the more it grows. And so this is maybe the beginning, or maybe this is the tipping point for someone to say, I carry this with me and I don't want to carry it anymore. I'm going to begin to take steps. I'm going to begin to move towards hope and towards healing, towards wholeness. And this just takes so much courage. So would you be with us this morning, Lord, as we begin to take steps in this? In the name of Christ, amen. All right, I think there was some discussion about the picked last or the lunch table story. There was some discussion about maybe when you were a kid and you got picked last. How would you define shame? If you were to just write a definition for shame, what would that look like for you? Where do you see shame and vulnerability linked together? What do you feel shame triggers in your life? Anger, aggression, passive aggression, violence, addiction, depression, eating disorders, lusts, overcompensation, strength withdrawal, or strength silence withdrawal. I should have put another option in there. All of the above. And then what might be a step for you to come out into the light? Right. Okay, that was a big one. So, if that was too heavy and you just want to you just kind of want to zone out for a little bit, I understand that too, because that's a lot. But take a few minutes and turn to the person next to you and talk about that, and then we'll have just a few minutes of discussion.